Good morning, everybody. I think everybody would agree the world is in trouble with respect to energy. We all know we're in trouble, big trouble, actually. And one of the very first things usually mentioned as something that might come along and save us is this so-called zero-point energy. My guest tonight, Nick Cook, wrote a book called The Hunt for Zero Point. Nick Cook is an award-winning defense and aerospace journalist who for the past 15 years has been aviation editor and aerospace consultant of the world-renowned trade publication Jane's Defense Weekly. Nick is a regular contributor to the Financial Times and has written for numerous newspapers in the United Kingdom. His analysis was sought by UK, US, and other world news media during the 91 Gulf War and the 99 Kosovo conflict. In his 18-year career, Nick has visited the world's leading defense establishments and has gained access to numerous top-secret military facilities and bases in the U.S. and former Soviet Union. In addition, Cook's two-hour documentary for the Discovery Channel, Billion Dollar Secret, detailed for the first time the inner workings of America's classified weapons establishment. In a moment, Nick Cook will begin reading totally classified documents to us. Now, naturally, I was kidding about the classified documents. However, if he wants to read us a few, that'd be fine. Nick, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Art, or good morning from London. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. That's right. It's morning now in London, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We have a suitably watery sun floating up above the London skyline here. So,
in other words, a typical London sun.
I'm afraid to say wholly typical, yes.
Yes. Here later today, we're expecting 50 mile per hour winds. So
wow.
The weather's getting pretty wild. Nick, I think it would be worth a few moments just talking about zero point itself. Now, at this point, zero point is really, I don't want to say it's a myth. It's a hope. It's a dream. But we can't put our hands around it yet and start running the power plants from it yet, right?
Right. That is true. I mean, I think it is more than safe to say that the idea that this zero-point energy field exists and that it is teeming with subatomic particles that flash in and out of existence, I mean, that is the concept of zero-point energy.
Uh-huh.
That idea is pretty well-rooted in science. The problem, of course, that we all face is coming up with an engineering solution to extract that energy from the vacuum of space in meaningful quantities. Because that energy soaks everything, of course, it is very difficult to get to. So I think the concept that it is there is undisputable. It's the challenge from here on in lies in extracting it. Now,
all right, what is the... I'd like to understand how undisputable it really is. What is the best evidence for the existence of zero-point energy?
Well, there are a number of experiments that have been carried out. I mean, one of the probably the best known is the Casimir experiment. Now, some people do dispute whether the Casimir experiment, which basically involves the placing of two plates, flat plates very close together.
Metal, right?
Metal plates very, very close together, separated by an infinitesimally small distance. Now, the pressure of the vacuum of the zero-point energy field presses those plates together. And that, in most people's eyes, certainly the supporters' camp, definitively proves that there is this thing, the zero-point energy field. Now, of course, others do dispute this, but in general terms, I think it is accepted that the zero-point energy field stemming from that experiment is shown to be valid.
How much evidence is there, Nick, that what Nikola Tesla was investigating was, in fact, zero-point energy?
Well, Tesla, of course, is a very famous case, and it's difficult to say definitively that what Tesla was tapping into again was associated with the zero-point field, but the zero-point field does appear to underlie a lot of these manifestations and effects that appear. For example, I know some of your. I'm not so familiar with Tesla. I know lots of people have made very, very in-depth analyses of what Tesla did. I kind of like to quote John Hutchison because I have made a study of John Hutchison, and I think he's familiar to many of your listeners. I mean, John is a Canadian. He's an inventor. He lives up in Vancouver, and his work, which basically involved John set up an amazing laboratory in which he used many, many different types of equipment, beaming energy into a localized area to manifest effects. Now, those effects stemmed from levitation. They stemmed from a molecular kind of disruption of the metals and materials that he put into the zone of influence. There were moments in which those materials appeared to be there and disappear, almost as if for a while they were there, but in some other dimension, perhaps.
Have you been an observer of his experiments?
I haven't been an observer of his experiments, but I have spoken to people who have. One of them, John Alexander, Colonel John Alexander
of
INSCOM, I'm sure, again, a name more than familiar to many of your listeners.
Yes.
I have spoken to at length about John Hutchison, and John Alexander was the head of an evaluation team backed with Pentagon money that in the 1980s went and evaluated the Hutchison effect.
Yes, John he has expressed some reservations, though.
His reservations were based on the fact that when they came up and did the experiments, the full manifestations of the Hutchison effect were not seen. But John has gone on the record, he certainly told me, that four out of the five evaluators of that team came away believing that what John Hutchison was saying was essentially valid. There was one skeptic in the camp, and he could not be convinced. But in many ways, this whole debate, this zero-point energy debate, is one of mindset. If you are predisposed not to see this, not to see it coming, then in my experience, no amount of persuasion is going to change your worldview.
Well, yes, but that would seem to suggest the ever so subtle nature of it. And if we're talking about something so vast, so giant, and ultimately so powerful that we can run our cities on it, that's a big thing. That's not a subtle thing. And if the demonstration is subtle, then I don't know, maybe it just does not have enough impact to suggest that kind of ultimate power.
Well, I think it is both of these things. I think it is a field that is there to be tapped into, and I do know of some inventors who claim to be doing this. In fact, I've seen enough data from what they have been doing to believe that they are doing something interesting. It's difficult to be definitive at this point. But I think it is also a subtle thing as well. I think it may underpin concepts for non-local intelligence, for being able to a medium by which perhaps we are able to do some rather extraordinary things like remote view. Perhaps clairvoyance might have some of its origins in the way that non-local intelligence is able to be transmitted instantaneously from one place to another.
All right, Nick, have you and I had a talk about my antenna?
We did you did mention your antenna last time I was on the show.
Right.
Has there been any new activity there?
Well, I just don't, and have never had explained to me adequately what it is that's being observed here. Of course, I built this as an antenna, not a gatherer of any sort of energy. Thank you very much. I didn't expect nor want it. But this antenna's fed up at 100 feet, and then you're talking about 3,200 feet of number 10 wire on 13 towers. It's a very, very large antenna, Nick. And on a clear, calm day with no clouds and no, you know, nothing going on in the atmosphere to account for it, there's well over 300 volts that's constantly on that antenna, which will shock the you-know-what out of anybody who deems to touch it. And we have experimented to some degree with it. Rise time, for example, you can take it and ground it, and then the next instant that voltage is right back as though there was no build-up time. It's just there, baby. And I, Nick, I had to go to extraordinary measures to protect my equipment from this voltage in terms of grounding, DC grounding, and all the rest of it all the time. 24 is it's always on ground. Has to be, otherwise the voltage would kill the equipment I've got. So I don't know what that is. I don't know why it's there. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know why it's manifested, but it is there. I've done some investigation, Nick. I've talked to electric companies, for example, because they have long unterminated sometimes lengths of electric cable that they're not using. And my theory is that there would be a similar buildup on miles and miles of electric cable. And sure enough, there is, Nick. The electric company regards it as a pain in the neck, and they ground such long runs that are being unused for that exact reason. But it's as though it's kind of like everybody knows there's something there, but nobody quite knows what it is, and they just treat it as a pain in the neck because they're trying to pass electricity or receive radio signals or whatever. But there's something, Nick.
Is this a phenomenon that they say is particularly local, Art, or is it something they've encountered in other areas as well?
It's universal, Nick. It's universal. And as I said, the electric company, of course, well, they're not trying to collect electricity, they're trying to sell electricity. So they just ground such long runs and don't think another thing about it, which is probably standard electrical practice anyway, but they do know about it, Nick. And others know about it, and I don't know where this power is coming from. There have been theories about, well, maybe the ionosphere or atmosphere in some way is collecting an electrical charge from thunderstorms that are always going on in the southern hemisphere and distributing them through the atmosphere. That could be. It could be a capacitive effect between the Earth and the antenna or wire. It could be a lot of things, or maybe it could have something to do with some power source that we don't understand, you know, like something called zero point.
Well, I think that's, you know, the key point there, and you know, it's so valid to this subject and others linked to it, is that there are things out there in the realm of physics that we don't understand. You know, I'm a journalist. I'm not a physicist or a scientist, but when I went to school and studied, there was this kind of view put out by my teachers that we pretty much kind of know everything that there is to know about physics.
Yeah, oh, yes.
And only really when I dipped into doing the research for the Hunt for Zero Point did I realize how little we actually have fathomed about the realms of science, the realms of physics. And there is so much so much work that is being uncovered daily, and on such fundamental issues. I mean, fundamental issues like gravity.
Well, it seems like an ignorant, insulting statement to say, well, you know, we pretty much know all there is to know about physics. Oh, my goodness. Why would somebody say that?
Well, you know, when I look at gravity, I mean, we know what gravity does. Its effects are very obvious. The fact that we are sitting where I am here and I'm not floating off into space,
yes,
is because of the effects of gravity. However,
yes,
what is not known is why a gravitational effect is induced. It is that fundamental fact is not known. There are numerous, of course, explanations for it, and the conventional one is that a mass will exert a gravitational pull on any object in its sphere of influence.
And the larger the mass, the larger the amount of gravity.
Absolutely. But actually, that's a pretty simplistic explanation. What is the fundamental root cause of that underlying pull?
Right. Now, I'm not sure it's explained at all by suggesting it's simply mass. Obviously, I think scientifically it can be related to mass, but that doesn't mean the mass itself is the underlying engine or reason.
Absolutely. Well, of course, if you talk to the zero-point energy proponents, they will say that it is the mass's movement through the zero-point energy field that induces a reaction from the field, which triggers in the mass, in the atomic weight of the mass, a gravitational force.
Well, Nick, you're apparently privy to quite a bit of secret information. Something that I've always wondered about, and I know many in my audience have as well, is the famous tether experiment. I mean, you mentioned the movement, and of course you'll recall the shuttle released a tether, and it was very long and was reeled out and suddenly produced this incredible voltage that virtually destroyed the tether, you know, just severed it at the point where it came together with the shuttle. It was an incredible amount of energy. There's never been another word about it. There's never been a suggestion to repeat the experiment, as far as I know, and there certainly has been no explanation about the amount of energy they received that literally destroyed the tether. What do you know?
Well, I wish I knew more about the tether art. I mean, we all specialize, and particularly at Jane's, we specialize in various sectors, spheres. Mine is aerospace. Now, that's predominantly air-breathing aerospace, stuff that flies within the atmosphere. Of course, I'm familiar with the tether experiment, but I've never done, to be fair, an in-depth analysis on it. But, you know, like you, I've picked up on those stories, and I've wondered about it, but I would hate to mislead your listeners by saying I had an inside track on it, because to be fair, I don't.
Well, but something was fishy in orbit, I'll tell you that. The amount of electricity was so astronomically larger than what their expectations were that for them not to have commented further and or done another experiment or given us an explanation means to me that they know something we don't, a big something that we don't. That tether was traveling at a great speed, and I guess they got it low enough to begin to perhaps even dip into a little atmosphere close to it, I don't know. But it was a remarkable find, Nick, and I'll bet you somewhere there's some sort of secret document marked tether top secret.
Well, I'm hoping that in, you know, X years' time, when someone does a little Freedom of Information Act digging, they might finally get to the root of it. There is a lot out there, as you know and document on the show, that happens that we just, in the military sphere, of course, that we as yet have only skimmed the surface of. And even doing what I do, which is, you know, working as a correspondent on the very edges of a massive, sprawling defense industry, there are umpteen things which I come across which I know are rooted in heavy, heavy secrecy, and which I'm just skimming across the surface of. It's intriguing, and it's frustrating at the same time.
So, Nick, are you convinced that freedom of information requests always yield the truth?
Oh, no,
I didn't think so. Hold on, we're at the bottom of the hour. I didn't think so. Coming to us from Great Britain, The Hunt for Zero Point, his book, Nick Cook, I'm Art Bell. You know, it seems to me that anybody who writes for, you know, the Financial Times, Jane's Defense Weekly, these kinds of very conservative, well-respected publications, and then ends up writing something like Hunt for Zero Point, I mean, you've got to wonder how that's going to come out with I don't know, your friends, your colleagues, the judgmental part of the world. How's it gone, having written such a book, Nick?
Well, I think anyone will know from having read the book, those that have, that I was very anxious about documenting this 10-year kind of journey of discovery, because it, as you say, went into some pretty esoteric areas.
Mm.
However, I am delighted to say that because of, I think, the way that I laid out my discovery process, which was on a very kind of skeptical basis, that what I was able to show was that, you know, I too came from a very, very skeptical background on this, and was able to overcome that skepticism and prejudice. And as a result, I think what has happened is that I've been very fortunate in people have responded to that very well. And thankfully, I'm still, you know, I'm still with Jane's Defense Weekly, and I'm still doing work for the Financial Times and others. It's been a the reaction has been very good, Art, I'm delighted to say, and even people within the aerospace industry have responded to it extremely well.
Do you feel that anti-gravity has been actually demonstrated?
Yes, I do. A very interesting, if you go back, for example, to Thomas Townsend Brown, that was a very interesting experiment. But of course, it's not actually one which is definitively proven to be an anti-gravity experiment. Thomas Townsend Brown, for those who perhaps may or may not know his work, said that he had found a way of controlling gravitation back in 1929. Now, there's been a great upsurge of interest in Townsend Brown's work.
What was the method that he used?
Well, he used, he was charging a capacitor positively on its upper side and negatively on the lower side.
Mm-hmm.
And that what that induced was a reaction which drove this disc-shaped capacitor, interestingly, the shape of a disc, towards the positive pole. In other words, it drove the disc to rise upwards. Now, he called that a gravitational reaction, an anti-gravity reaction. There is, however, unfortunately, there's a very polarized view about that. It's recently cropped up again because of interest in lifter experimentation. Again, I'm sure your listeners have come across these lifters, but basically they replicate the Brown effect, although they look completely different. These are balsa wood models made out of a balsa kind of frame construction with aluminium foil. Again, you charge a wire positively on the upper side, you charge the foil negatively, and these lifters will rise. Is that an anti-gravity reaction? Many people, I tend to agree with them, say that it is not, that it is something called iron wind, the flow of molecules over the foil, inducing, if you like, an aerodynamic type effect, aerodynamic lift.
Yeah, to the person who watches the videos and the recordings, it certainly appears to be anti-gravitic, doesn't it?
Oh, it looks extraordinary, and,
yes.
And I've witnessed lifter levitations and effects, and it is a bizarre experience. This thing crackles with energy. It is there's this kind of ozone-y kind of smell around
mm-hmm.
it.
Yes,
it is very dramatic to watch. It's crackling with ionization, and it's very easy, I think, to say, yep, that's an anti-gravitational reaction because it looks so strange. But at all times, it behoves us, particularly when we are moving in this world, to quantify these things, to be skeptical, to be rigorous. These, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, and we need to be rigorous. For my money, Townsend Brown's work, as interesting as it is not definitively an anti-gravity effect. Others, I think, are inducing anti-gravity or gravity-reducing experiments. I'm referring to the superconducting camp. Again, some of your listeners may be familiar with the name of Dr. Eugene Podkletnov, a man who was experimenting with superconductors.
Yes.
And who found, almost by mistake, that objects suspended above this rotating superconducting disk were losing some of their weight.
That's right.
3 to 5%.
Now, there's been quite a period of time that has elapsed since that experiment. In fact, he did measure, as you mentioned, a change in the actual weight of the object, which does seem like anti-gravity. There's been quite a bit of time that's gone by. Is there been anything that challenges the validity of that measurement?
I don't think there's anything that challenges the validity of the measurement, although, of course, what we all really want to see is someone replicating that experiment out in the open.
Right.
Now, what is, to my mind, persuasive is that you're not just getting one individual, Podkletnov, out there saying that he's doing this, he's achieving this effect. You're getting multiple people throughout the globe, at least half a dozen people, saying that they are experimenting with superconductors and getting interesting results. Now, back in May of 2003, I attended a two-day conference in Washington, D.C., which was interestingly underpinned with Defense Department money. And at that conference, a lady by the name of Dr. Ning Li, who had been employed by NASA and is a very credentialed scientist, was effectively saying the same thing, that her work in superconducting rotating disks would lead to considerable weight reduction effects, but also energy generation effects. She was talking about 11 kilowatts of energy. So it's not just Podkletnov. There are others who are independently saying the same thing. And that, to my mind, is persuasive, particularly when these people are credentialed. They have a lot to lose.
Oh, yes.
Career-wise, going on the record about this.
Yes, indeed. Nick, so there you have what you just described. Now, if there's really something to this, then surely our governments must be far advanced from what we're hearing about, or do you think they're clueless? I mean, after all, Nick, so many of us have had these objects not fly, but float above our heads. I had one float above my head. It was clearly defying gravity, not dependent on gravity nor the amount of air under any sort of surface to keep it afloat. This thing defied gravity. I've seen it. Millions have seen it. I hate to drag you over into the UFO corner, but these things are being seen on a regularly scheduled basis, Nick. They appear to be defying gravity.
Well, obviously, in the Hunt for Zero Point, I very deliberately put the whole UFO thing on one side, Art. But that's not to say that I'm not I'm leery of discussing the UFO phenomenon. Actually, I'm not. And I'm given kind of confidence in being able to discuss it by the fact that I've recently come across a lot of papers written within the aerospace industry itself. A very interesting one, actually, came my way a couple of weeks ago from McDonnell Douglas. Now, McDonnell Douglas, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, doesn't exist anymore. It was overtaken by Boeing several years ago. But this paper, which was written by a McDonnell Douglas engineer in the early 1960s, it's a 40-page paper, is seriously promoting within McDonnell Douglas the idea that UFOs should be studied from an aerospace perspective to gain insights onto their propulsion methodology. Now, whatever I may think about UFOs, and by the way, I do believe that the phenomenon is real,
Remember, you're only saying unidentified flying object. You're
absolutely
not saying alien. You're not saying anything at all except unidentified.
Absolutely. And you know, I think one should always be very careful to maintain that stance. These are unidentified flying objects. It is a phenomenon, but it is, in my view, a multifaceted phenomenon. There is no single unifying point description of what a UFO is.
All right, well, what I was trying to drive through, though, is if you heard this scientist make this statement in an open conference, then why should we not imagine that, in the secret locations like Area 51 near me or all over the world, there are others, work is not far, far advanced in this area already?
Well, I've covered the activities of the black world in the aerospace field for a long time from its periphery. Of course, no one in my position is able to penetrate it with any great degree of success.
Well, what kind of hints have you had, Nick?
Well, I know what the black world is capable of on a conventional level. I've seen the stealth revolution. I've covered it firsthand. And I know that what drives the black world is a sense of vision underpinned by a great deal of money and a freedom, if you like, in which to pursue visionary projects.
That's right.
Now, if you put all of that together and couple it to a zero-point energy anti-gravity type mindset,
yes,
it is inconceivable to me that the high payoff that is promised by that research would not be undertaken, looked at, and covered within the black world. What I have to be careful of, though, is saying I have seen no proof that it is being done, and I haven't. What I have seen proof of, particularly in recent months and years, is that the white world of the aerospace industry is showing increased interest in zero-point energy and anti-gravity.
Now, is there any way at all to follow the money, Nick? I know the black budgets are carefully protected, but I wonder, you can always get something if you can follow the money, right?
Absolutely. Well, follow the money was one of my kind of key guiding tenets when I wrote The Hunt for Zero Point. And there are periods of time when you can follow the money. The World War II period was one of them. But, well, as you know, in the black world, that money is essentially unaccountable.
Right.
That's not to say that it is completely unaccountable. No one has oversight of it. But they know that because you can follow the money, that those budgets are very carefully hidden away.
Mm.
So you can't, in the black world, follow the money to that pot of gold, which is a flying saucer powered by some anti-gravity lift engine.
Okay.
At least I haven't been able to do it. But there are clues. There are clues there.
And that's what I was asking about. Where do you see clues that this kind of work might be going on?
Well, I see the clues in the white world. I have seen, for example, that the U.S. Army has pursued its own Thomas Townsend Brown experimentation.
Oh.
It's there. You can. I found it on the U.S. Army's website. Looking at their research and development activities, and that was within the last couple of years. I've also seen, and it's fascinating, this one, that the U.S. Army Redstone Arsenal, where they develop advanced concepts, for example, for ballistic missile defense, employed Dr. Ning Li, this Chinese-American lady who had been playing around with superconductors,
yeah.
And incidentally, Ning Li was saying that one of the effects she got from this, that she aimed to get from her superconducting discs, was a force field beam which would be able to deflect objects. The U.S. Redstone Arsenal in Alabama was looking and paying Ning Li to further investigate those concepts.
Why do you think the Army, Nick, of all the services to be pursuing this, you would not think Army first?
You wouldn't think Army first at all. But in this uncertain era in which we live, this era of massive asymmetric threat, to use the core parlance of the Pentagon,
mm-hmm.
wherein you can get 9/11 type incidents dramatically overturning the status quo in an instant. What you are looking for as an antidote is a truly transformational weapon system, something that totally leapfrogs the state of the art. Now, something like Ming Li's force field beam, which incidentally as well was reflected by Dr. Eugene Podkletnov working over in Finland, who was saying exactly the same thing. If you can deploy that beam, point it into space, deflect a rogue incoming nuclear warhead, or for that matter, somebody you consider to be the bad guy, his satellite, you can do extraordinary things. Things that to a simplified eye would appear nothing short of magic, but which actually is firmly rooted in some pretty far out science. So all of these things, I think, are now on the agenda. That's why the Defense Department is looking at transformational weapon systems like this, like microwave weapons, lasers, and other directed energy devices.
And so this Chinese scientist you were talking about, she works for us, for the Defense Department?
She does. This was a contract. In fact, she was paid, her company was paid $500,000 by the U.S. Army's Redstone Arsenal to further develop her superconducting rotating disks, specifically to develop these force field effects.
And exactly how far along do we know her to be?
Well, this is an interesting one, because I met and interviewed her at this conference in Washington 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And she was quite forthcoming. She didn't want to discuss her military work. She struck me as an enlightened individual who would like her work to be done for peaceful purposes, but she's caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, in that she knows that the best, perhaps the only means of short-term funding is through the military. But what she was saying was that she was very close to developing hardware, and that this
anti-gravity hardware.
Yeah, this is a force field beam. What Podkletnov terms a pulsed anti-gravitational beam, which she was saying would generate 11 kilowatts of energy. Now, in an initial application, that's quite a lot, but in its
But with what kind of input to achieve this?
You are you're talking about a jolt of electricity into the influence of the superconducting disk of a couple of million volts. So
to get it going,
you're sending this. It's a pulsed beam.
Yes.
It's a zap, if you like.
Yes.
But this pulse is generated by an intense burst of electrical energy, which is then fed into the superconductor, which is inducing these strange anti-gravitational or gravity shielding effects, and you are sending that pulse along a linear path of some considerable distance.
All right, hold it right there. After all, writing for the kind of publications that Nick does, one could imagine that somebody deep in a black project somewhere for the good of the world suddenly might, well, you never know, feel that they've got to release some sort of very secret document that probably ought not be released. So let's imagine they slip it to our friend Nick here, and this document is the classified smoking force field of the world. I mean, it just, you know, lays it all out. Exposes the fact that we've investigated and found the source of zero point and have utilized it in anti-gravity devices in some way. I mean, we've got some mature technology that's absolutely secret, and they come to you and knock on your door, Nick, and they say, for queen and country, son, you've got to keep this to yourself. What would you do?
Well, there are different categories of secrecy, Art, and you know, doing the job that I do, I always have to apply a filter to anything that comes my way. I mean, part of the filtering process is to be very rigorous about the evidence. Another part of the filtering process is to weigh whether the information that comes to you and whether you ultimately put out in the pages of a magazine or wherever is going to damage national security. Now, I am I'm a Brit, but I'm a patriot, just as anyone in a sensitive position in America would be. Mm-hmm. And I have to be very careful with some of the information that I come across, because yes. I don't want to endanger anyone's life or operational security
right.
any more than the next
of
person.
Of course not.
So therefore,
if you got a document like this, Nick, and then they appealed to you on the basis of Queen and Country, national security, not to release the information, what would your inclination be if you were in that kind of a pickle?
Well, again, it depends what the information was. If it was information that was going to jeopardize national security or someone's life by my releasing it, then I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it because I'm not in the business of doing that. If it were a piece of information that was sensitive because it was politically embarrassing or it said something which the establishment did not want out, let's say, for example, that someone had thrust a document under my nose saying, we have anti-gravity devices, they're being tested at Area 51, and here's the proof.
Yes.
I would not consider that, I'm afraid to say, a militarily, operationally sensitive piece of news. And I would really have to be persuaded that that was going to endanger someone's life by my putting that information out there.
Well, here's the way
I'd publish it.
Here's the way I imagine it, Nick. I imagine that, for example, the military might stumble across a technology that, on the one side, from our point of view, could be an energy source that could really help the world. However, from a military point of view, it could be a weapon or a shield or a who knows what that would have a great deal of very urgent military capability. Unfortunately, releasing the energy that drives this thing, would give the weapon away. So I don't know what the military would do in such a case, but I just have a feeling they might not hand it over to industry right away.
Absolutely. And that is, you've hit on the duality of this technology.
Yes.
Proponents, of course, say that it is clean, it's free, it's limitless, and it's going to save the world. The flip side of that is that there is inevitably going to be some military application for it. We were talking about Podkletnov's and Dr. Ning Li's beam weapons earlier.
Yes.
The U.S. Army would not be interested in this technology if they didn't think there was some potential in it. There is always this dual nature to the technology, but it's the same with nuclear power. You get a weapon from splitting an atom, you get energy from fusion. When you are down to the atomic and subatomic level, you are playing with fundamental forces which are potentially hugely powerful.
Right.
And as yet, we don't know the full potential of that power.
You've mentioned that you have a filtering process. Have there been occasions, Nick, where you've come upon information that that part of your patriotic filtering process would not let by?
Well, I have certainly, for example, in my daily work at James Defense Weekly, I have come across information either in the form of documents or what perhaps someone has told me that at the forefront of my mind, I know is going to be operationally sensitive and could endanger life. And I'm talking about here things like, you can imagine in a magazine like Jane's or any actually trade magazine covering the aerospace and defense industry, that we get information quite a lot about things like the frequencies of radars, the frequencies of radio signals, very kind of pernickety details, if you like, about how weapon systems work,
right.
Which in the hands of a potential adversary could be put to use for them, the adversary. I am very careful about disseminating that information, as I say, because it's a technical consideration more than anything else.
And it wouldn't necessarily add to the value of the story to disclose that anyway, so I
understand. Absolutely. It would be salacious and gratuitous. But
yes.
If it's a political sensitive fact that is mere, the reason for the secrecy is merely to cover something that could be embarrassing or could be secrecy for its own sake, then I put the story through those same filters. But chances are, when I've done all the checks, ticks and balances, I will know that this story is safe to publish because no one's life is going to be endangered by it.
All right. Maybe you can help me out with something else that I've been struggling with for some time now. It's kind of off subject a little, although it's not in another sense, Nick. There are a lot of stories, very important stories right now, about the environment and about what's going on, for example, with the Gulf Stream. Stories that, for some reason, while very important to the entire world, we don't see published here in the United States. And yet, they're in Britain on a regular basis. You are publishing them along with the rest of Europe. And it worries me that we appear to have our own kind of filter here at the U.S. border, and we're not getting these stories. Thank God for the international news, but it does make me curious. I wonder if you've noticed any of that, Nick.
Well, of course, I'm peripherally, well, we're all interested in the environment and climate change and the impact that it's going to have on the planet. Professionally, it's kind of on the periphery of where I am. And yes, of course, I've noticed that you in the States have a more perhaps jaded eye cast on the effects of CO2 emissions and other pollutants on the atmosphere. I think it's a cultural thing. We in Europe tend to be more tuned into that kind of thing, and I think soon, though, Art, if some of these scientists are right, and that we are undergoing a period of irreversible climatic change, that the effects of those changes are, obviously they're not localized; they're going to be manifest everywhere. And I think as that evidence mounts and develops, that debate is going to become centered in the U.S. just as it's now very much alive over here.
Yes. Well, I keep getting it. I get it from the London Times. I get it from Ireland. I get it from all over Europe. But I don't get it from my own media, national media. I mean, if a ocean current has slowed to a quarter of what it was, with global implications, it just seems to me that's worth a line or two of U.S. print. And I'm just astounded at, somehow I've always, frankly, thought of Britain as more likely to keep something secret than my own government here. And yet, the opposite seems true.
Well, yeah, actually, it's funny. I've done a great deal of study on secrecy and the nature of secrecy, and what I found is that here in the UK there is a tendency to kind of make secret those things that don't need to be made secret because it's just easier to set in place a bureaucracy where you restrict the flow of information. In the States, I found that up to a certain level, the flow of that information is very free. I get probably much more from the DOD in terms of generally releasable but still quite sensitive information on military technology than I do from my own government.
Really?
But
maybe it's one of those the grass is always greener syndromes.
Well, possibly, but what I do see, though, is that you get up to a line in the States when it comes to secrecy, the line that is drawn very firmly over classified technology and systems. And that line is watertight. It is a system that has been put in place, it's been operating for half a century or more, which is specifically there to protect military secrecy, like the compartments of a watertight ship. And those compartments are so securely defined, it is very difficult, of course, for any one person to get a big picture of what the overall system, if that's what you're talking about in terms of a military secret, is. And I found that in the States. I've encountered it in a number of fascinating instances. You know, I've been into places like the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, a place which is renowned for its kind of black program work.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I've butted up against the black world in that sense. And it's a regime which I find fascinating for all its kind of paradoxical qualities, but there is a point beyond which in the States you just cannot go, and you know that's very firmly rooted in your culture.
So then somebody like yourself has to look to these scientists like the Chinese one you mentioned, Chinese lady, who make sort of drop statements at certain places and times in the public, and you have to attach perhaps more meaning to them than their brief utterance would indicate.
Absolutely, but there are moments in space and time when information does surface. It happened, as I'm sure you know, in the atomic process when discussion of fission was free and easy in the 20s and 30s leading up to the Second World War. But as scientists realized that a bomb of awesome power was potential from the development of fission physics, that debate was stopped. It was stopped and cut dead in the United States for that very reason. And there are moments, too, here when discussion of things like perhaps even zero-point physics is allowed to surface and circulates freely, but suddenly it stops.
That's right.
To get back to that case of Dr. Ning Li, for example, it's very interesting that she has now disappeared off the planet. It's very, very curious that this lady, you know, who was very free and open,
disappeared. Let's stop there for a second. Disappeared off the planet. What do you mean?
Well, when I say off the planet, people have been trying to get in contact with her, me included, for the past 2 years since she surfaced at that conference.
Yes.
And she is number unobtainable, absolutely impossible to find. And again, that may be a misreading of things, but it is certainly very curious, and some would say suspicious, that this lady who is financed or was being financed by the U.S. Army to come up with transformational weaponry, potentially, has suddenly disappeared off the face of the globe at a time when her experimentation was tipped to be yielding some very interesting results. So these curiosities, they've surfaced in the past in the world of atomic physics. They may be surfacing and disappearing now in the realm of zero point energy.
Gosh, Nick, have you stumbled across the story of the disappearing biologists? You
not
wear
really,
that?
No.
There's a.
No, not really. It's
yes.
not a story I've followed. What is the story?
Well, there are various people keeping track of the number of scientists working in, you know, some perhaps areas of interest to the U.S. government in biology that have just suddenly, mysteriously died in various ways. And there are quite a number of people keeping track of the numbers, which seem unsettling. Of course, you don't know what the normal attrition rate would be, but the numbers do seem unsettling. And I wonder if a little of this might be going on here.
Well, it may be. I think the difficulty that the government is going to come up with is that, you know, there is a great, I think, yearning or kind of willingness for this technology, which is being tinkered with now by the inventor community, is put to good use. And I think we are now much more, as a society, jaded about the intentions of the military, the intentions of government, suppression of technologies. You know, people who say they are getting demonstrable results from zero-point energy devices that pull, you know, soon, I think, useful amounts of energy from the vacuum.
Well, Nick,
say that,
know,
they want this to be put to good use.
Yeah, you know, Nick, these great minds tend to come up with ideas fairly in a synchronous way. I mean, if it's in the black world, then probably somebody like a John Hutchinson out there is going to stumble into or discover what's being worked on at a much more secret level. And one has to wonder what would be the fate of somebody stumbling into a technology that perhaps the government doesn't want stumbled into.
Well, again, it would depend very much, I think, on what that individual had stumbled onto. As you mentioned, there are this activity is very synchronous. It's popping up now all over the planet, and it's linked by the Internet. It's very difficult to suppress. And I think that if you want to suppress it, the way to do that is to pour scorn on it sooner than actually resort to drastic action, like kind of rubbing out the scientists who are involved in it. So, I think one would, if the government had a mind to do this, it would employ a more subtle range of techniques based on disinformation, ridicule, those sorts of things to delay the onset into the public domain of these kinds of activities.
So it could just be that a scientist who had stumbled into something incredible might have a terrible run of very bad luck and bad publicity and bad happenings in his life, so distracted that he couldn't really pursue what he wanted to pursue.
Yes, I mean, that's possible. I think, sadly, unfortunately, you know, a lot of people who are involved in this area are quite kind of suspicious and perhaps even paranoid by nature. And a few kind of, I'm not tempted to say bad apples, but a few of these guys who tend to dwell on the bad things that have happened to them in the process of developing or trying to develop hardware, tends to give out the impression that they are, you know, being hounded by government operatives, and you know, they are about to be, their lives are in danger or whatever.
Certainly, those stories are legion.
They are legion. They are legion, and I'm not saying that in some cases they aren't true.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is a wider temptation by the general public to believe that that is prevalent. And certainly, in my investigations of these things, I have not come across that level of paranoia and secrecy.
All right. Hold it right there, Nick. We're going to be shortly taking questions for Nick Cook, who is my guest. And, of course, he wrote Hunt for Zero Point. I was saying it's a book that just doesn't seem, Nick, like it goes away. It's here and here and here and here, and it just sort of stays alive. How do you account for that?
Well, it's been an extraordinary ride, Art, the past couple of years. And, actually, when I wrote the book, I fully intended that I would go on to do something else. I would go on to some new project in some totally different arena. But what I found is that it just keeps on pulling me back. And, in fact, finding myself in this position, in being this kind of almost unwittingly, this connection between the inventor community and the world of aerospace and defense that I report on has meant actually that I can't escape it. And in fact, what I've done is I've actually set up a company, and if I may, I'll just give a website address for that, because it's called www.highfrontiers.co.uk, which is designed to act as this kind of connecting nexus between those two worlds, because I've just been getting so much interest from the aerospace and defense community coming to me and saying, tell me more about this zero-point energy stuff. Tell me more about anti-gravity.
Well, and I have a lot of listeners. I mean, here's Wiley in El Paso, Texas. Ask Nick for a direct email address to contact him about a topic of interest. Now, that means that somebody out there has some piece of information they want to get you, and I'm sure you get it's like trying to solve a crime for the police when they put out a tip line. I mean, if you give out your email address, you're going to hear from every inventor and brother and sister and relative of every inventor who thinks they've got the, the real thing. And
well,
it's a lot to sort through, I'm sure.
There is a lot to sort through, but what I want to be able to do is to act as this facilitator, if you like, between those two worlds. And anyone who does have a particularly, I'm talking about developments in hardware, that prove a demonstrable effect, if they want to email me at info@highfrontiers.co.uk, we've just set up the website. It'll be up and running properly in a week or two. But there's an initial capture site there. They can register their names. They can register their interest. And at the appropriate time, in a few weeks' time, we will be able to get back to them and enter into this dialogue. And I'm really setting this up not just for the inventor community, but for anyone who has an interest in the subject from any community. I mean, just to give you an illustration of the wild kind of ride that's been going on these past 2 years, last year I was invited down by some people in Costa Rica to go and brief the Costa Rican government on zero-point activities. Costa Rican government, which Costa Rica is an interesting place. It doesn't have, for example, any armed forces, and it's able to plow the money that it would otherwise spend on defense into some quite innovative areas. And
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, they were looking to set up a kind of a community area which would allow for the development of these technologies. So, you know, I'm very happy recognizing now that I can't disassociate myself from this book, which has just taken off and run, I'm delighted to say. And you know, www.highfrontiers.co.uk is aimed to be this facilitator which will enable this dialogue to I hope reach a wider audience, particularly in conventional areas, because I'm very interested. I feel very driven, actually, to break down these barriers between these two worlds.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'd like to take a few calls. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Nick Cook in Great Britain. I'd like to remind everybody, you've got to kind of ask your question and then pause, because we have a built-in pause going all the way to Great Britain. So, caller, go ahead.
Good morning, Art, Mr. Cook.
Good morning.
This is with reference to Art's antenna. He keeps wondering why he has that spontaneous voltage on it. Considering that the Earth's equatorial speed about its axis is 1,037 miles per hour, considering 36.2 degrees north equates to 897 miles per hour, would that not equate to approximately a generator speed of 460 revolutions per second? And if you double the output of any generator, doesn't that quadruple its output if you double the RPMs?
I absolutely get the theory, and I've heard it from many people. Thank you. Many people believe me. And I don't know. That may be the answer. There is a sort of a generator, perhaps a generator-like effect, you know, we are in rotation after all, right, Nick?
Absolutely. I mean, I wish I knew enough about the principles to be able to comment on it in any depth, but it's as good a theory as any.
That's exactly the way I look at it. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Nick Cook. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, this is Ron. I'm from Rochester.
Yes, Ron.
I've been involved in the hunt for 0 points since 1991, and there's a couple of interesting thoughts that I wanted to share with you. Nick, being from England, probably is aware of John Searle's work, right?
Right.
Okay. There is another book that I had just come across. This is out of print. It explains levitation, anti-gravity, and also free energy from a different perspective that I have ever seen before. And it also shows that this information is encoded into everything the Egyptians knew. And it is based on angular momentum, and it could be explained over the air in 2 minutes. I'm not going to do it now, but it is just amazing, and I know it works, and it can also work with an electron flux motor, which is probably what the ETs are using, not a simple mechanical device.
Well, clearly, the Egyptians had something going that we still are unaware of, because they moved blocks we can't move and did things we can't do yet, so... that's an interesting sort of angle on all of this, Nick. Instead of looking forward and into this, you know, the secret nooks and crannies, it may well be that the past, whether it would be an old man in Florida at the Coral Castle or the Egyptians building the incredible things they did, maybe the answer is long ago. What about that?
Well, I agree to an extent that there are mysteries in the past which do, they certainly do need to be explained. And it certainly may be that there were things known to the ancients which have been forgotten to us today. For me, an interesting illustration of this is the recurrence in Vedic texts of the use of mercury as a medium for an engine for crafts that the ancient Indians, the people who wrote these Vedic texts, would talk about in some length and to some detail. Now, mercury, interestingly enough, has cropped up again and again and again in my research. We see, for example, we haven't talked about this very much, but during the Second World War, when the Germans, research that I uncovered in the Hunt for Zero Point, the Germans were working on some extraordinary devices, one of which was a thing called the Bell, which had a mercury-like substance in it, which was rotated in two counter-rotating discs at great speed and induced what appeared to be fluctuations in the space-time matrix. Now, you get that resonance with the Vedic texts, all, you know, stretching way back thousands of years in history through to the German period during the Second World War, and now there is emerging research which says that mercury in certain heated up states acts like a superconductor, and strange and magical things happen, like, for example, weight loss induced by gravity shielding effects, getting us back into the realm of Dr. Podkletnov, Ning Li, who are again playing around with conventional superconductors, who are saying the same thing, that all of these things tend to link up, and some of them, as Ron has observed, go back, the links to them go way, way back in history. So I think there are some interesting lessons to be observed. We need to be very careful and very rigorous, though, about how we make those claims and how we investigate them.
It always seems to be rotation involved. There was an article in Pravda, which is really out, pretty far out, but interesting. It's called Time Can Be Turned Back. You might have seen it in your rumblings around the Internet, but Pravda really did print it. And it says that 8 years ago, American and British scientists who conducted investigations in Antarctica, this may not be perfect, it's a translation, made a sensational discovery. U.S. physicist Marianne McLean told the researchers, and they all noticed some spinning gray fog in the sky over the North Pole, the exact North Pole, on January 27th, which they believed to be perhaps just some sort of ordinary storm. However, the gray fog didn't change form, nor did it move in the course of time. The researchers decided to investigate the phenomena, launched a weather balloon with equipment capable of registering wind speed, temperature, and air moisture, but the weather balloon soared upwards and immediately disappeared. In a little while, the researchers brought the weather balloon back to the ground with the help of a rope attached to it previously, and rather surprised to see the chronometer set in the weather balloon displayed the date of January 27, 1965, the same day 30 years earlier. Really crazy stuff, but printed in Pravda. You ever look into something like that?
Well, this story did come across my desk, and so I'm aware of it. Now, having said that, I bet it's the same for you, Art. If you had a penny for every one of these stories that came across your desk,
you bet.
You know, and you could verify them, you'd be a very rich man by now, and so would I. The difficulty with these stories is that they surface, they on the outside look very interesting. The difficulty relates to the fact, though, that there is rarely any verifiable backup to say that they really happened. And one of the things that I really wanted to do in the Hunt for Zero Point, and I think one of the things that people have responded to very well about the book, is that everything that's in there is quantified and backed up by evidence. And where it isn't, I say it's not. But there are very few places where there is no evidence to support the fundamental data.
Or the Philadelphia experiment, Nick. Remember the descriptions of the Philadelphia experiment?
Absolutely.
Rotating RF fields and magnetic fields, absolutely fascinating stuff that would seem to sort of fit into the same general description of a lot of what you talk about when you're talking about zero point and some of the experiments going on.
Well, indeed, and I mean, the Philadelphia experiment is a great case in point about, you know, a myth or a story that won't go away. And on the surface, to someone like me, and certainly when I was initially investigating, doing the research for the Hunt for Zero Point, the Philadelphia experiment, on the face of it, is something that I wouldn't have touched with a barge pole. You know, any discussion of a ship that disappears into the ether, no way. But when you look into it, you realize that the myth may be hiding some very valid research.
It sure may.
And what it appears to be, certainly, was an experiment for a radar stealth device, which I think was absolutely true and borne out by the facts.
I believe it as well, Nick, just based on the fact that the Germans were sinking our ships trying to get across the Atlantic in droves. The death toll was horrible. And we really wanted a way to make ships virtually disappear. And so I wouldn't be surprised that something like that was definitely worked on. And while I don't buy everything connected with the Philadelphia story as told by some today, there's some basis of truth in the nugget of all of that.
Well, I agree. And again, in The Hunt, I do discuss at some length how these stories surface, how they more often than not do contain, where the myth is really strong, at least a grain of truth. And I think that is the case in the Philadelphia experiment. I do think it related to a radar stealth experiment. And I do believe, by the way, that there may have been some strange phenomena manifestations which the original experimenters weren't counting on when they were evaluating this technology purely from a radar stealth perspective. So, and what's interesting, too, is that I've encountered more recent research which shows that others were working in the same area. The Germans, there is a story going around, again, it's seems to be based on some quite valid research, that the Germans also had their own version of the Philadelphia experiment. And certainly when you look at, I mentioned a moment or two ago the experiments done by the Germans, detailed in the book about these this contra-rotating device down a mine, which appeared to be creating fluxes in the space-time metric. Those sorts of stories are also associated with a kind of Philadelphia-type experiment that the Germans were doing in Kiel, Germany, during the latter part of the war.
Is there some documentation for that?
There is apparently some documentation for it. I haven't been able to locate it myself, but I think someone who's known to your show, a guy called John Dering, who I've interviewed and found very plausible and persuasive. I mean, John works for a highly reputable aerospace company over there in the States. And, John's research into areas like the Philadelphia experiment and the German equivalents of the Philadelphia experiment, I found to be very persuasive. And, he is, convinced that there is fire where this smoke exists.
Well, I think most of us are familiar with the story of the Philadelphia experiment. Is there an equivalent tale attached to what supposedly was going on in Germany?
Yeah, it's remarkably similar, actually. It does relate to a ship which was fitted with these intense electrical generators, and aspects of the story resurface, not the whole full-up, the ship disappeared into a different dimension, people were fused into the decks of the ship, none of that stuff, but enough of an echo there, but distinct from the Philadelphia experiment, to show that the Germans were working in the same area.
Huh. That's absolutely fascinating. I'd never heard that, and I would love to know more. I'd love to know more.
I'm working on it, and in fact, research for A Hunt for 0.2 is very well advanced.
Oh, it is?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. As I said a moment or two ago, this, a couple of years ago, was a subject that I thought that I would leave behind and move on into new areas. I just thought I would just continue off into some new realm of research. But it's pulled me back to such an extent that I've even actually had to take on support staff here to respond to the overwhelmingly amazing kind of responses that I've had about the book. And one of the kind of drivers behind that is now to get Hunter 0.2 out. And the book is about 95% researched.
Is there a great deal of new material since the first book?
There is. And obviously, I can't go into it in any great detail because I wouldn't want to spoil the impact of the book, but there is a tremendous amount of new information that's out there.
All right. On that note, here, we're going to pause at the top of the hour and continue to take questions from Nick Cook. I didn't know the next book was about out. 95% done, but he can't talk about it. We'll make him talk about it. We'll be back shortly. Surely there are some things you can tell us about your new book. Give us an idea of direction, where you would go from The Hunt.
Sure. Well, as I said earlier, this past couple of years has just really been this amazing kind of ride. And I found myself kind of caught in this kind of roller coaster, which has taken me to all these wonderful and exotic places that I really never expected to go before I wrote the book. So to a degree, the format of the first book will certainly be continued. It will be very much my personal journey, the places that I have visited, the places that I'm able to take the reader to that are perhaps beyond their most people's, I'm very fortunate doing what I do, which is working on the edges of the aerospace and defense industry, to go to some very strange and exotic places.
Yeah, it opens a lot of doors.
And it does, and it does. And that journey goes on, and there'll be more of that in the second book. But there were two fundamental questions which were left unanswered at the end of the first book, and those need to be answered when I write the second.
Right.
The first was, show me a zero-point energy device that works.
That's right.
Well, I've seen that. Okay, so that...
All right, well...
I can't go into it in any great depth. Because that's gonna have to wait for the book.
I mean, are you really convinced you have seen that?
Yes, I am. The one that I have seen passes muster. This thing is generating usable amounts of electricity in a low output form at first, but I have no doubt that it will continue to develop greater amounts of useful power, but certainly enough at the moment to power a laptop indefinitely.
Can you tell us if this has come out of the UK or the United States or somewhere else in the world?
I can't, because for the moment I have sworn to the individual that I'm going to maintain a discreet silence on it, but we have agreed that the workings of the device can be and will be detailed in the book. So I hate to be kind of, I hate this to be a tease, but that was one of the fundamental questions that I needed to have answered
before
I wrote a second book.
That's a good one. And the other one?
The other one is seeing an anti-gravity device.
And?
Now, I haven't done that yet, but I believe that there are two or three candidates out there that are currently in the hardware development and demonstration, or about to be coming up to the demonstration phase, which I am hopeful at least one of them will demonstrate to me that visible effects, anti-gravitational effects, are out there and possible to see.
Okay. I've had for years now Dr. Stephen Greer on my program. He's been on an intense search for the same sort of thing that you have, Nick, and I wonder if you two have run either into each other or no doubt many of the same people in this journey.
I know that we've run into some of the same people. I haven't run into Stephen Greer personally. I'm more than familiar with his work, and in both this field and in the UFO field,
right,
the disclosure
right.
field. But no, I haven't come across, we haven't bumped into each other personally, but, you know, I'm hopeful that will happen one of these days.
All right, let's go back to the lines. First time caller line, you're on the air with Nick Cook. Good morning.
Good morning. Art, I want to tell you, I think you have one of the most significant radio shows ever.
Thank you. I agree. It is a significant program.
And Nick, this is a very interesting subject, and I wanted to know what you guys thought about how this might relate to the intense geomagnetic storm that happened last night. If in any way, I got home last night, I looked up into the sky, and it was one of the most intense aurora borealis that I've ever seen in my life.
Well, I don't know that. Maybe it does in some way relate. I really don't know. Nick, we are having an intense geomagnetic storm. Last night, at about this time, it was really raging, unbelievably. I don't know that there's really any direct connection to your work, but I suppose the geomagnetic field is loosely connected to it all in some way, perhaps, huh?
Well, I wish I knew, to be honest. Whereabouts are you? Where is this geomagnetic storm going on?
Oh, well, Nick, it's going on all over the world. That caller was probably in more of the northern latitudes, but, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, we had a pink sky here down in the desert. I'm rather south, as it were. And so it was a worldwide event. The sun really let loose with a full coronal discharge, and it was earthbound directly and hit our magnetosphere, and we had quite a display of lights and so forth. So it's a loose connection.
Yeah, I mean, I've witnessed the aurora borealis up in Canada, and it's a fantastic sight. To be honest, I don't know how this would link in, if at all, to the main area of my research, except, of course, that, you know, we do know through programs like HARP, the atmospheric experiment that the DOD has been conducting up in Alaska, that manipulations of the ionosphere are possible.
Oh yes. Have you looked much into HARP, by the way?
Not extensively. No, I haven't. But you know, it's symptomatic of what we discussed earlier, which is that the DOD is interested in what would previously have been described as exotic science to gain transformational leaps, quantum leaps in capability beyond where we are at the moment.
There's no question about it, and you might look into HARP, Nick. You really might take the time, and that might be one door you could get partially unlocked. But it's an absolutely fascinating experiment they're doing up there, and you might look into whether they'd let you in that door at all.
Yeah, well, I might just make that application out and see where it goes.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Nick Cook. Hi.
Hello. Nick, you may know be my another name. I wrote the Space Daily piece as the Air Force Enemy of Space and the Sudan Publius Rex while I railed against John Jumper, so be on the lookout for an email from me. There seems to be two schools of levitation out there, two camps. You've got your Larry Smalley / Ning Lee spinning death school and the Ventura lifter folks. And I know of one individual at the Marshall Space Flight Center I think would like to speak to you, so be on the lookout for an email from Publius Rex. I have one concern. I think that rocketry research may be undermined if all this turns out to be an illusion. Besides, a true zero-G environment with no electronic signature might be best. If you tried to, say, grow a graph plating in an artificial zero-G environment generated by other graph plates, it might be like holding a mic up to a speaker. You just get feedback and tainted results. So hopefully we won't use this to undermine heavy-lift rocketry research, especially now that they're going to be building both EELVs up here in Decatur my way. It's like they're going to be building both the Atlas V EELV and the Delta IV up in Decatur. I think what's really sad is that seems like we've been distracted on jet airplanes like this $200 billion Joint Strike Fighter fiasco for so long.
Caller, the fact that they've pulled back so hard on heavy rocketry might indicate to you that they know there's something else afoot, eh?
Either that or they could be fooling themselves, or they've stumbled onto something that, like I said, it's something that it might have a small effect, but if you wanted to build, you know, a true zero-G research lab in a natural zero-G setting, you would have something where you could actually grow graph plates, where if you tried to have a graph plate and grow other ones, it'd be like holding a mic up to a feedback loop. I just hope we don't undermine our heavy lift rocketry research, especially seeing both Boeing's sea launch and the Lockheed Martin Atlas V use engines that wound up, you know, that started off being used on the Inner Gear Baran space shuttle.
All right. Well, let's talk to Nick about that a little bit. Nick, we are sort of pulling back. I mean, in the heavy rocketry category, could that be because we know we're on the verge of something that will eclipse all of that? I understand this gentleman was no doubt concerned about jobs in that industry and all the rest of it, but could it be we're on to something else?
No, I think we need to be very clear about what's happening here. Certainly in the white world, what we are seeing in terms of manifested effects is at a very early and rudimentary stage. This is stuff that's going on in a laboratory, and certainly in terms of applying that, if indeed we get to points where we can get usable amounts of force field from these devices, is a considerable way off. I don't even want to go into the kind of whole black world arena, because if it is in the black world, then it's compartmentalized and secured away so tightly that we're not going to see that for decades to come. But with these things that people like Dr. Ning Li and Pod Kletnov are doing in the laboratory, how they get applied to weaponry, or indeed more applicably to spacecraft of any description, is some considerable way down the pike. So we need to continue developing what I call conventional technologies.
Nick, how hard have you tried to find her?
I've tried pretty hard, and I know some people who've done some research for me and for themselves who've tried even harder, and they are just getting a serious, serious blank. So if she's listening, if she's out there, I wish she'd register on the website, www.highfrontiers.co.uk, and I will I'll be the first person who'd like to talk to her.
What do you imagine might have become of her?
Well, of course, you know, it would be very convenient to say that she's made a breakthrough, and that the breakthrough is so stunning that her work went immediately classified. But certainly, given the direction of her talks, the fact that she was saying when I interviewed her that she was poised to develop a device which would generate 11 kilowatts of energy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, you know, it's a pretty significant breakthrough. And if she was on the verge of it and achieved it, because of the truly out there nature of that breakthrough, it would be transformational. It would be a quantum leap. It would not surprise me if that were suddenly shut down into the realms of classified activity. But, you know, one needs to be careful about this stuff, because she might just have dropped out for a completely different reason, which is maybe she's got family problems or she doesn't want to involve herself in this research anymore.
Mm.
But it certainly looks, given all that interest and the money that was being invested in her by the U.S. military, by the U.S. Army, it seems kind of odd that she's just dropped off the face of the earth.
Kind of odd indeed. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Nick Cook. Hi.
Oh, you don't know what a thrill this is, Art. Nick Cook. First of all, I got a comment on what you were talking about on the Philadelphia experiment, and then a question, and then I'll get off and listen on the air.
Sure.
My father worked at the Philadelphia Naval Yard through the entire Second World War, and towards the end of the war, when those so-called Philadelphia experiments were going on, he came home one night and suddenly announced that he had quit his job at the Naval Yard. He was white as a sheet, and he just told my mother and us four boys that he quit because he looked forward and thought he was going to be laid off as soon as the war was over. And then I myself spent 27 years in the Air Force, and I was in Spain, and here comes the question on his anti-gravity and going back to the past for the answers. I went to Segovia in Spain, and they had an aqueduct 4.5 miles up into the mountains, each stone sitting on top of one another with no cement or anything else, weighing about a ton apiece, 800 feet in the air that was built, they said, in 500 B.C. Now, I can see personally, and I've been in a quandary ever since I saw that amazing thing, which is still being used, as to how, other than anti-gravity, finding a way to have anti-gravity, how they could build such a structure, bringing water from 4.5 miles up into the mountains, down into the town of Segovia, without having had the answer to anti-gravity.
Well, I wish I knew. I mean, the short answer is, of course, there are many places in the ancient world where you see that kind of ability to construct those edifices reflected. I mean, you see them in South America, you see them in ancient Egypt, you see them, well, Segovia in Spain is a new one on me, but you see them all around the world. I don't know enough about it to be able to say definitively that they'd tapped into some knowledge which we don't have access to routinely anymore.
It was astonishing. It looked like it was built yesterday. The stones were as white as could be from the day, I guess, they were put up. And the other thing is, I almost forgot, my father would never talk about the real reason that he quit working as a supervisor of building ships in the Philadelphia Naval Yard.
All right, well, there you are. Then, of course, there's also the Coral Castle. There are many things that are just inexplicable that have happened in the past that would seem to suggest that some technology was known or understood that's been forgotten or is very black today.
Yeah, I think that is true. I mean, there are undeniably things in the black world which are quantum leap gains over where we are today. They may not be in fields as radical as the ones that we are talking about to be deemed worthy of ultra classification. I mean, you know, one that I've been looking into recently and which I hope underpins what an earlier caller was saying about how, you know, we really need to be very careful about pursuing these technologies in parallel. But I've been looking into hypersonics, you know, the ability of aircraft to fly at speeds in excess of Mach 5. That work is going on now faster and in more depth than at any period in U.S. military developmental history.
Really?
Absolutely. There is a surge of activity now in hypersonics. That's, in fact, there are white world demonstrations planned to get a hypersonic cruise vehicle flying within about 8 years. But there are enormous technical challenges involved in that. I mean, we tend to blithely say, oh, you know, a plane like Aurora must have flown because...
I was just about to mention Aurora, so...
Yeah, well... You know, I'm a believer in Aurora in the sense that something was tested and flown. I don't think that it was put into long-term operational service, but I've seen enough evidence to think and believe that some kind of capability was tested, and I think it was put up there for a short while, the concept was validated, and it was then kind of boxed away and mothballed when satellites were shown to be able to do the job more cheaply, because, of course... In, you know, particularly in today's era of more constrained budgets, that sort of activity is really frowned upon. You know, overlapping activity
when
you've got satellites to do the job just as well.
Yes. But speaking of aircraft and invisibility, do you know of any work going on to make aircraft invisible
to the human eye? Yes.
Yes, indeed.
Definitely. I've spoken to people in the Air Force about past experiments in that area. There are a number of ways of achieving it. Boeing, interestingly, flew an aircraft during the 1990s, which they called the Bird of Prey, out there at Area 51.
Yes.
And the Bird of Prey was an extremely unusual-looking aircraft, and part of the rationale for making its shape very distinct was to fool the human eye into thinking that you were looking at something else. Now, there are other ways of achieving optical invisibility, and certainly this is one that I've been told about by Air Force insiders, is that you coat your aircraft with a kind of a polychromatic film, which has sensors embedded in it, as well as the electrical devices which are able to change the color of the skin to mimic the background. Either if you're looking from below, it will mimic the sky background.
Chameleon-like, actually. Hold tight, we'll be right. Nick, I get these wonderful little computer messages as we go zooming along in the program, and Glenn in Seattle, Washington asks, Art, ask Nick if he's heard any rumblings on advances in the field of teleportation. I'm sure he's had his ear to the ground in search of anti-gravity and may have stumbled across something interesting in the field of teleportation. What about it, Nick?
Well, teleportation did hit the news recently. A friend of mine, a guy I know quite well called Dr. Eric Davis, wrote a teleportation study for the U.S. Air Force and published this towards the end of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And it caused a great deal of furor in the business. I mean, for a start, people were wondering why the Air Force might be funding research into the teleportation arena. You know, connotations of Star Trek and the beam me up and down Scotty device. But Eric is a very serious and credentialed scientist, and actually, as I understand it, his paper went more into the kind of, it was more like a kind of remote viewing aspect of teleportation. In other words, it was kind of talking about bilocality, how you can be in one place physically, but you can psychically, I suppose, for want of a better term, view your surroundings in a remote location. So it was that aspect, really, of teleportation that Eric was addressing. But the fact that the Air Force is funding this stuff to the tune of, I don't know, $200,000 maybe, shows that people out there, it's what I'm saying really all along, is that people are looking in the government and in the military for unconventional solutions to today's rather unconventional threats and problems. So they're looking to gain those kinds of edges from wherever they can in the science community. And if there's a breakthrough to be had, then these guys want to go out and get it.
Gotcha. First time caller line. You're on the air with Nick Cook. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, Art. Good morning, Nick. Quickly, I would like to get your point of view on something. I work in the aerospace industry, specifically with helicopter company, and I noticed in the NASA budget just recently they've reduced, almost eliminated, the NASA Ames research when it comes to rotorcraft technology, specifically blade design, and since you've been talking about levitation technologies this morning, I was wondering what your views are of this cutback in resources for this part of the industry.
Well, I know that there is tremendous competition for what is increasingly becoming in the days of the Cold War, you had a pretty much limitless R&D budget. Nowadays, of course, there is immense competition for all the many areas of research that the aerospace industry and the Air Force and NASA behind them have to undertake. I don't know the reasons for cutbacks in helicopter blade technology, but I can imagine that it's probably fallen foul to some priority in another area. I mean, for instance, I mentioned earlier that what the U.S. Air Force and NASA and others now are looking at in great depth is investing more money in hypersonics, speed regimes in excess of Mach 5. Now, you can't get those kinds of gains, which are incredibly difficult to master technologically, without robbing from another part of the research and development budget. And so I imagine that that is what has happened here. It's not that what is being done at NASA Ames there is not a priority. It's just that something else has surfaced, which is a greater priority, and funds have to be allocated to that.
Yeah, I kind of thought that since you're talking about all this new technology, I just believe in some manner that our government has a big hand in this type of development. I was just, I just thought it was a curious current, now that you've been talking about this type of technology. But thank you for your reply.
You're very welcome. Thank you for calling. Wild card line, you're on the air with Nick Cook. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, Nick.
Hi. Good morning.
Yeah, You know, a lot of things were created by the garages and stuff like that of, Apple computer and, Microsoft started from nothing and stuff like that. Basically, have you ever heard of what is called the floating bed?
I can't say I have.
Okay, that was basically created up in 1939 in Canada, and it does exactly what you're looking for.
You're saying it levitates.
It definitely levitates.
And is it still demonstrable today?
Yes.
I tell you what, if you want to register onto my my website, www.highfrontiers.co.uk, and register your name, I will get back to you, and we can have this discussion about this technology, because I'd really like to know more about it.
All right. There you have it. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Nick Cook. Good morning. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, I got beat there just the last second. Good morning, gentlemen. Great show.
Thank you.
The question I have for Mr. Cook is if he's ever investigated or done any research into the gravitational propulsion, like sites on Google or whatever, and if he has he found anything that seems viable? However, after that last caller, I think we got the answer.
Well, I wish it were... good morning, by the way. I wish it were as simple as that. What I found when I've done my research on Google and elsewhere is that there are a lot of very bold claims out there. People say that they've got a theory, or people say they've developed something. The difficulty, of course, is transcending this into firmly documented evidence. And for me, the ultimate litmus test, the acid test of all of this, is to be able to see something that flies. I've seen a lifter fly, but as we discussed earlier in the program, it is highly debatable whether that is a pure anti-gravitational effect. I suspect not, sadly. However, they are very dramatic to watch. What I want to see, and what I hope to be able to see certainly this year, I'm monitoring a number of very interesting projects out there, is something which defies the laws of gravity, certainly, and maybe even the laws of physics as we understand them, in the form of an experiment. And it's that demonstrable proof that is so elusive in this game. But I think it's out there. I think it's coming. I think it's ultimately a very hopeful message. I'm convinced in the not too distant future we will see something that's demonstrable and that works.
Thank you very much, Jance. It was a great show.
You're very welcome. West of the Rockies, you're on air with Nick Cook. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Hi, Art. Hi, Nick.
This is
William from Portland.
Yes.
I was wondering, even though Art grounds out the unwanted voltage from his antenna, could it be hooked up as a power source? And if so, would the power output be constant, and would it increase with a greater length of wire?
I don't know. Those are all really good questions, and I don't have the answer to them, particularly with reference to the amount of current available. I don't have that answer yet, although you can bet we're going to investigate. So I would think that it's all a matter of scale, and if my 5 acres of wire is picking up that kind of voltage, then one would imagine higher and longer wires would pick up yet more. I don't know. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Nick Cook. Hi.
Hey, Art, you have a fantastic radio show.
Thank you.
Great. Mr. Cook, have you ever met Thomas Bearden, and what do you think of his work, and what do you think of his MEG?
I haven't met Tom Bearden, but we have been in some dialogue over the years. As you may or may not know, I mention Tom Bearden's MEG at the end of the Hunt for Zero Point. The significance of it at the time I wrote about the MEG was that the U.S. Patent Office had just accepted a patent application on it. And as I'm sure you know, the Patent Office is very leery about accepting patents on devices that are either so-called free energy devices or perpetual motion machines. So the mere fact that they accepted that patent for Tom Bearden's MEG device struck me as extremely significant. The pity is that since then we haven't seen any commercially derived hardware stemming from that theoretical breakthrough. I hope that it's coming. I understand that it's been bogged down as much by commercial differences between the partners involved in that venture. But I'm certainly involved in discussions with people like Tom who have developed similar devices. So I know that they're out there, and I think Tom Bearden's doing great work. And I hope, you know, that his Meg achieves the success that it deserves.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Nick Cook. Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Hello.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay, this is Vito from Roseville, Michigan.
Yes.
Yes, sir. Like a few years ago, when the Russians put their first spaceship up there, the very, very first one, the Sputnik, I worked for an engineering company. We were doing work for the tank arsenal, and a bunch of the engineers and I were all talking about it, and I mentioned to them, I said that if they had a, if you have a copper coil around the spaceship as it passed through the magnetic field of the Earth, it would generate electricity.
Much like a motor, yes.
And I think that's the same principle that maybe Tesla had if he had the high towers up in the air, the same reason why Art's getting electricity from his towers.
I don't know. That may well be. Again, Nick, is this an area that you've looked into?
Well, you know, I always feel I have to stick within my area of expertise, and that's certainly not one of them. I find, you know, clearly that the amount of responses you're getting about this shows that it's a subject of great interest to everyone. I think it's peripheral, really, to what to where my investigations are going. But I'll certainly be monitoring the website to see if anyone comes up with any solutions to your problem there, Art.
Well. It's not a problem in that I have solved it. My radio equipment is safe, but it is something that I feel deserves to be explained. And, you know, who knows if something like this really has potential, but it is energy, and it's not discernible where it's coming from. So that makes it interesting. International Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello there.
Hi. You're on the air with Nick Cook. Welcome.
Oh, good. Yeah, I was curious about some images I've been seeing for some time now, and I've noticed on Nick's website, he's actually using one of them, and it's these World War II Nazi UFO images. And I was just wondering, I've never been able to find out if they've been debunked or if these are considered valid.
Well, I'm intrigued because I don't think that's my website, because my website...
American Anti-Gravity?
Oh, that's not mine. No, that's
not yours.
That's somebody else's. But they do very generously give me quite the book, The Hunt for Zero Point, quite a big plug. So I'm very grateful to American
Anti-Gravity.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
They do very good work, and it's a very good website.
Have you seen?
What do I think about?
There's some that are
UFO
quite large, sitting by a house.
Oh, one at a time.
There's some that are there's pictures of these big saucers sitting by a house with from a distance. They're pretty amazing, and some of them are flying, and I've seen them around, and I've never been able to find out if they've been validated or not.
All right. Well, that's always a question with UFOs.
I do go into that in the book in some depth. It's a bit like the Philadelphia experiment. There is a lot of smoke surrounding that particular fire, but when I did the digging, fully expecting not to find anything, I was encouraged to find that there were some very secret activities underway during the Nazi period, during the war, funded by the SS, not the mainstream armed forces, which were looking into power plants that could have propelled disc-shaped craft. Now, where are these disc-shaped craft? Well, funnily enough, actually, I do know a guy at the moment who is doing some quite interesting digging into former top secret Nazi research sites in the Czech Republic, who is hopeful of finding some interesting technology down there. He's also actually looking to raise funding for his dig, so if anyone wants to get involved in that venture, again, log on to my website, register your interest, and I can put then in touch with this guy who's really done some great work, actually, in validating a lot of this very top-secret work into German advanced propulsion techniques.
I'm very interested in that. If you get a call from somebody, Nick, who says they've got the Holy Grail, and you become sufficiently, I don't know, convinced by evidence tossed at you by whatever means, email or however you're lured in, do you actually get in an airplane, travel, and look at devices, and how many times have you done that?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I've done that, and I wouldn't dream of putting anything in the book or in the new book that I haven't actually personally gone out and validated face-to-face myself. Of course, what you have to do is there's so much information out there and so many people. You know, I'm delighted that so many people have got in touch with me, but, of course, I can't follow up every lead physically. So I employ the filter. I find out which inquiries are based on, first of all, theoretical advances, which are based on hardware. And it's really the hardware stuff that I'm interested in, because anyone can talk up a theory. What we need to do is see hardware that works. And I think, actually, Art, that what will happen is, because this is so out there, it's so on the edge, that people tend to be or seem to be developing, certainly in the zero-point energy generation side, hardware in advance of the theory. The theory is so sketchy that things, that manifestations of these effects are being pulled from wherever, let's call it the vacuum of space or the zero-point field. But there is no good fundamental theory underpinning where these effects are coming from.
Right.
And I think that what's going to happen is eventually science theory is going to catch up with the hardware and we'll map out what's going on here. But for the moment, we are really, to a very large degree, swimming in the dark.
All right. Well, one quick question I think we have time for. Hello there. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Nick Cook. Good morning.
Good morning. Art, it's a true pleasure.
Thank you.
Yes, I have a question regarding the German technology. I'm a researcher myself, and I've been dabbling in micromagnetic energy. And my name is Thurston. I'm from California, Southern California.
Yes, sir.
And I found a stunning similarity to what's going on politically and what's going on with the German technology with the Third Reich trying to take over the world utilizing such a thing.
Well,
again, what's going on right now?
Yeah, again, I guess there is a lot of old information to be gleaned about what the Germans were doing. I don't know if it's all out by now or not, Nick.
By no means all out. My research, and again, this will be detailed in the follow-up book. Let's call it the Hunt for 0.2, is going to, I hope, really kind of take the lid off that very compartmentalized, very secret, and but very fundamental research into some of the things that we're talking about here. Advanced propulsion, they were into directed energy weapons, but all of this activity was contained in an environment not dissimilar to the way that the black world has been set up today, in a very highly compartmentalized way, very difficult to access, and in a way that history has not documented.
All right.
And that's where I'm going to be going.
All right, good. Nick, meanwhile, your first book is still available, isn't it?
Very much so, and I'm delighted to say doing brisk business, which is very gratifying.
So there you are, folks. If you want to know more about what you've heard, Amazon.com or whatever, and the Hunt for 0 point, and coming out soon, about how soon, Nick?
I hope to have it out next year.
Next year?
Yeah, it'll be, I mean, the research is, as I said, about 95% done, but we hope that the book will be available next year.
You don't really have a title, do you?
I've got a number of titles that I'm working on, that are working titles, but I, there's nothing I'm putting out yet.
Okay, my friend, good luck and good night.
Thanks, Art, very much.
Take care. That's it, folks. It's been a wonderful weekend. Thank you all from the high desert this night, this weekend. It's good night.